From ABC News, this is a special edition of Perspective. I'm Dave Packer. The Power of Us, an exploration on what we can do to preserve our planet. The electric vehicle craze has died down, but new innovations in fuel could be the next big solution.
These are fuels that are in production today. It is happening now.
The technology and the possible obstacles to get it to the market. The ugly truth about where our single-use plastic bags go.
What is the carbon footprint of trying to send a shipment of plastic 9,000 miles away?
The efforts to change bag recycling programs and saving the honeybees.
They're our world's most crucial pollinators.
Teams across the country do their research and explain why these insects are so vital. All ahead on Perspective. This week, a special edition of Perspective. This episode is part of a series from ABC News for Earth Week called The Power of Us. It's special reporting on the climate challenges we face and how we, together, can find solutions. We start with the efforts to mass-produce alternative fuels. This week, Tesla, the biggest electric vehicle manufacturer in the world, reported its earnings for the first quarter, and the news wasn't great. Revenues were down 9% year-on-year, and it comes as demand for EVs overall appears to be slowing down. But ABC News technology reporter Mike DeBusky takes a look at why that's happening and how certain gas-powered vehicles may be sticking around with the help of a new fuel type.
The electric car revolution has hit a few speed bumps lately.
EV sales are slow.
Tesla drivers, listen up. You should check to see whether your car is part of a massive recall.
You've probably seen all the headlines about electric vehicle sales.
According to Kelley Blue Book, just under 270,000 EVs were sold in the first quarter of this year. That's up from a year ago, but down from the last quarter of 2023. Alexei Golub has driven EVs since 2020. Right now, he's in a Hyundai Ioniq 6. And he says while he likes the car, it's not without its frustrations.
3 out of 4 chargers were down for maintenance.
A 2022 J.D. Power survey of more than 11,000 EV and plug-in hybrid owners found that 20% of drivers who visited a public charging station ended up not charging their vehicle due to the technology malfunctioning or being out of service. And while public charging infrastructure has seen federal investment since then, Golub says it's still finicky. And it gets crowded.
If there is one or two people in front of you, instead of staying at a charger for half an hour, 40 minutes, you stay there for that, like, times 2 or 3.
That, he says, can make long-distance travel impractical, like when he tried to road trip his previous EV from Philadelphia to Denver.
I stopped during that trip 17 times, 40 minutes to an hour each.
Alexei is an early EV adopter, someone who's more willing to deal with some of the frustrations that come with new technology. But more mainstream consumers, who automakers are trying to attract now, generally have a lower tolerance for those frustrations. In March, the Biden administration announced new EPA regulations for vehicle emissions, which are less aggressive than the agency's original proposal from last year. They also allow automakers more time to meet targets.
Starting with an available hybrid powertrain.
Companies like Ford and General Motors have said they're using the extra time to reinvest in hybrid technology, which pairs electric motors with traditional gas engines. But others have focused on how to make the cars that are already on the road greener.
Hi, I'm Ralph Diemer, the CEO of the E-Fuel Alliance.
Diemer says e-fuels are carbon-neutral fuels. They work just the same way our existing gasoline and diesel does. They can be transported in tanker trucks, go into gas stations, and we can fill up and run our cars the same way we do now.
The end product, actually, if you take the example of gasoline, is a gasoline which you can use in any current car on the road.
Or off the road, for that matter.
We try to go as high as possible with a Porsche 911.
In December, Porsche set an altitude world record, driving a car to the summit of the Ojos del Salado volcano in South America. The car, the heavily modified Porsche 911, was powered by e-fuels.
These are fuels that are in production today. It is happening now. And they're using existing technology both to be produced and to be used.
Meg Gentle is the executive director of the board of HIF Global, the company that made the e-fuel that went into that off-road Porsche. Both companies are part of the E-Fuel Alliance, and Gentle says the goal is to create fuel in such a way that the pollutants that come out of the tailpipe can be recaptured and made into more fuel.
So they're considered carbon neutral, right? Because we captured CO2. We also re-emit the CO2 because the engine works in the exact same way, but we're not bringing any new emissions into the atmosphere.
That's important, Diemer says, because the cars, airplanes, and ships that are currently driving, flying, and sailing likely aren't going anywhere in the short term.
But of course, we have around 1.4 billion cars on the roads in the world right now, and most of them have combustion engines. They won't disappear all of a sudden, meaning you would need a solution at least for the existing fleet.
Kelly Blue Book reported last year that the average car on American roads is now 12 and a half years old. Boats, on average, are in use even longer. Advocates like Diemer say adding e-fuels to the mix could make those vehicles greener in the short term, while the broader transportation industry figures out a way to stop burning fuel altogether. But it's not that simple. For one, e-fuel is tough to get your hands on. Right now, HIF is the only company that makes it, and it only sells to Porsche. It's also expensive.
I like to think of it anywhere from twice the cost of gasoline today to as much as an order of magnitude more.
That's Dr. Ian Rowe with the U.S. Department of Energy. Another challenge for e-fuel, he says, is whether the energy used to make it is truly green.
E-fuels require a lot of renewable electricity. And until we can really deploy the amount of renewable electricity needed to make this feasible, it's just not going to be able to make a huge dent.
Rowe and Diemer say all this could change as more companies invest in the technology and build out production facilities. But all the experts we talk to agree that the cost of e-fuels right now, plus the lack of investment to get them up and running at scale, means they don't really make sense for use in the cars that normal people drive every day.
It's very difficult to see a scenario where e-fuels could be deployed large scale to meet things like the light duty sector. However, I think there's a reasonable path to meeting some of our heavy duty needs.
That means using them to fuel things like passenger jets and cargo ships. But Rose says that's only going to happen by crafting policies to incentivize the large companies that operate those vehicles.
E-fuels can be competitive in those larger markets once they have some kind of benefit in place to value their reduction in carbon intensity.
There's already been some movement on this front.
So the Inflation Reduction Act has actually done a lot in terms of incentivizing the R&D and tax credits needed to make e-fuels a reality down the road.
But he says more needs to be done at the highest levels of government and industry.
What's really going to be needed is a confluence of these technologies, learning how to scale up, renewable electricity deployment, and policy coming into place that can support them.
Reporting for Perspective, I'm Mike Dubusky, ABC News.
Coming up, a tribal community fights to get a basic necessity, with or without the government's help, when this special edition of Perspective continues after this.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Perspective from ABC News. I'm Dave Packer. Our special edition episode continues, The Power of Us, highlighting the things we can all do to combat the challenges surrounding climate change. One action we've all been told will help, recycling. It's become part of our daily lives. Recycling plastics, especially those plastic shopping bags, has also become popular, with many Americans believing their bags will end up in a recycling center. But is that actually true? Last year, our investigative team, with the help of some of our ABC News stations, put 46 trackers on plastic bags and drop them in recycling bins at Walmart stores in New York, Florida, and Kansas. And where the majority of those bags ended up, may surprise you. ABC's Matt Gutman explains the long, strange trip and the reaction from Walmart executives to Brad Milkey, host of our daily news podcast, Start Here.
These ended up in places like Indonesia and Malaysia. Why Malaysia?
In 2018, China banned the import of plastic. And so that's where we used to send most of our plastic for many years. And they would somehow recycle it or change it or just dump it. But China decided this was not something it wanted to keep doing and stopped it in 2018. And other countries picked up the baton. And countries like Malaysia and Indonesia started to import our plastic. The problem, Brad, is that so often the plastic that we send is not recyclable. It's plastic waste that ends up just being chucked or dumped or burned in other people's countries.
We have about 30,000 residents here, surrounded by forests, surrounded by river.
We met an activist named Puole Pang, who has been working against some of these facilities that take in the plastic and then either try to convert it to pristine plastic, to recycle it, or end up dumping it or incinerating it.
People from America, you created too much of your waste that is a problem now.
And she's been fighting this for years.
And more, you see? Italy, Ireland.
And she showed us the backs of the facilities where they are allegedly dumping plastic waste right into rivers.
So this is how they dump their waste. And then this is just in the backyard of the factory.
The plastic fragments of our trash sometimes ends up in the very fabric of the soil, on leaves, on blades of grass, just sort of enmeshed in the nature there of what used to be this pristine jungle.
We have a broken system. We are not as capable as your people think that we can handle your waste.
So it was pretty jarring to see the result of what happens when we try to recycle plastic in this country and where it ends up. And not just that, but think about it. What is the carbon footprint of trying to send a shipment of plastic 9,000 miles away? Our analysis of shipping data estimates that shipping all that plastic 9,000 miles away, round Africa, up to Asia, pumped more than 100,000 metric tons of CO2 in the atmosphere just over the past 3 years. And this is just for shipping plastic.
Wait, and so, like, why are these companies taking all this plastic if it's not going to be recyclable? Is it just the idea that companies here in the U.S. are so desperate to get rid of it that they're like, yeah, if you're recycling it, we'll pay you to take it off our hands? And so there are companies around the world being like, great, you'll pay us? Who knows what happens to it after that, but we'll take your money for sure.
Yeah, and some of them actually want the plastic. If it is the kind of quality plastic that can be recycled, it's valuable. The problem is a lot of the plastic is contaminated and it's of poor quality, which means it ends up having to be incinerated or dumped. And so what we found, Brad, is that some of these companies, according to data that we got from the Malaysian parliament, says that at least one of these companies that our trackers went to does not have a license to import, apparently. Another one of the companies does have a license to import. But the question is, you know, this is a gray zone at times of where this plastic ends up, who ends up buying it, and what they end up doing with it. The bottom line is, American consumers who think they're doing the right thing by dropping off their perfectly pristine and clean plastic bags at plastic bag recycling bins at countless big box stores across the country, they don't know that the vast majority of what they're dropping in does not end up getting recycled. In fact, some of it gets shipped thousands of miles away, possibly to be dumped in another country's backyard.
Right. And I know the thing you've been driving home has been like, it's not like recycling doesn't work. It's specific so often to plastic, basically, and especially plastic bags. Is the moral of the story then, Matt, on the U.S. side of this, that they are like, what are the companies doing about it? Are they fine essentially sending this stuff off just so that they're able to say it's been recycled? Or are they genuinely in the dark that this is just ending up in the backyard of like this activist?
I think that's unclear. What we do know is that we've been trying to ask Walmart these very questions for a year and a half, and they have declined our request for interviews.
Let's get time to talk about this. I'd love to learn more about.
Well, we have a room actually right here. If you would come.
I'm sorry.
We actually went to a conference where we found Walmart's chief sustainability officer and asked these very questions.
We've been trying to for over a year now, and we've been flatly rejected by your team.
Okay.
So I wonder if you would go on the record because this is important.
And
she said, "Oh yeah, email me let's sit down, let's do an interview. And of course, we did just that. We planned an interview. They offered a date. We said, okay, we'll be there. And then just a few days before, they canceled that date and they didn't answer any of our specific questions about plastic recycling and then just sent us a statement from the company. And they basically said that they strive to do the right thing, noting that their program isn't perfect, but they said it does provide recycling access to millions of customers. They also said they're changing some of what they do, that they're continuously improving their recycling, including new contracts requiring companies to prove that collected materials are recycled as much as practicable.
The challenge will be to bring some pretty disparate groups together. There are some groups that believe that we should basically keep producing what you produce and recycle your way out of the problem.
So if you poll all of the consultants and everybody working on the plastic pollution problem, the one thing pretty much everybody agrees upon is that the only way to truly stop the plastic pollution problem is to cap the production of new plastic, basically make less of it.
It sounds like you're saying something kind of novel for the US government. It sounds like you're willing to accept putting limits and capping the production of new plastic
not
products.
Not necessarily.
But a representative of the U.S. government, a senior-level diplomat for the State Department, who is working on this possibly historic U.N. treaty on plastic pollution, told us that the U.S. government is not going to put a cap on plastic production.
ABC's Matt Gutman with Brad Milkey of our daily news podcast, Start Here. The power of us also includes the power of a community to take matters into their own hands. One tribal community, tired of waiting for the federal government or corporations to act, delivers basic utilities to those who have waited years to get it. ABC News Chief Meteorologist Ginger Zee travels to the Navajo Nation to talk to the founder of Navajo Power.
Along a seemingly incalculable horizon, a legacy of energy injustice hangs heavy over Navajo Nation. There are 15,000 households, up to 60,000 people here, that have never had power. Brett Isaac is trying to change that.
One thing that always upset me kind of growing up was being able to witness how close we are to opportunity, but yet not actually touch it or have access to it. That's why out of that frustration, I created Navajo Power.
Navajo Power has a mission. Bringing clean energy to families who have lived without electricity. Eleanor moved back to her family's land 11 years ago.
I'm getting emotional about this.
She uses propane to cook, a car battery to charge her cell phone, and sometimes she drives more than an hour just to plug in and make lesson plans as a substitute teacher. As we drive to her home, Brett tells me about the Bennett freeze.
It essentially closed off parts of infrastructure.
The federal law that made it nearly impossible for parts of Navajo Nation to develop their land until it was lifted in 2009. No water, no home renovation, no electricity.
Was there malice in this? How do you tell someone you can't connect to the world until the year 2009 without some...
This is when they were trying to create incentives for Native people to move to urban areas and essentially assimilate into it.
Brett and his crew.
That's the base.
Yeah, so we have, this is our racking and framing equipment.
Are installing solar at Eleanor's traditional hogan.
Okay, push star, mm-hmm. And then you're gonna put in that number.
And then, the moment that so many of us take for granted, Eleanor hitting that light switch for the first time.
Yes. Look at that.
Oh, my.
How does that feel?
It's unbelievable, mm-hmm. Being out here and having lights out nowhere.
Her food going from the barn into a refrigerator for the first time.
The limitations are still present. And the battle is still ongoing to find solutions. Using solar allows us to have access to the amenity, but minimize the burden and the impact on the land. It's by people from here, built by people from here, and for people that are living here.
ABC's Ginger Zee reporting. Coming up, an assessment on how the U.S. is doing on climate change and whether it will be a major issue in the upcoming election on this special edition of Perspective, after this.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
From ABC News, this is a special edition of Perspective. I'm Dave Packer. Coming up, finding medicine in movement and nature. But first, we continue our Power of Us show. It's part of a series of special reporting from ABC News highlighting the climate challenges we face and how all of us can find solutions. As nations around the world adopt different strategies to tackle climate change, how does the U.S. measure up? Dr. Brian Henning is the director of the Gonzaga University Institute for Climate, Water, and the Environment and tells ABC News if the U.S. is making the grade.
As we celebrate Earth Day again this year here in 2024, it's really important as we experience larger and more severe impacts from climate change, we really see that climate change is no longer a problem for the future. We're experiencing it now. And the longer we wait to take significant action, the larger and the more complicated those problems get. That combined with the fact that we know that the community members who are least responsible are most affected, and there's also a really fundamental justice issue involved with climate change. If I were to give a grade to the United States on its report card for Earth Day, as a hard grader, I would probably give us a C minus. We're doing finally some things that what I would consider adequate. We still have a lot more that we can and should be doing. The United States is finally taking really significant action for the first time ever through the Inflation Reduction Act, combined with the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law. Those two pieces of legislation are the single largest investments our country has ever made in climate action. And so these once-in-a-generation investments are starting to come into, across the country and are really focused on those communities who are most impacted. One of the things that's really also exciting at the federal level, this is a renewed focus on what's called environmental justice, this idea that those who are least responsible are most affected. The government is trying really hard to get money to communities who need it the most. So I'm really excited about the fact that we're finally doing more.
Dr. Brian Henning with Gonzaga University's Institute for Climate, Water, and the Environment. As we get closer and closer to the 2024 election, some activists are trying to make climate change policy front and center. But there may be some uphill climbs with attracting voters across different ages and party affiliations. ABC's Mary Ellis Parks talks to those who are sounding the alarm about the work that still needs to be done.
Emily Church is a biologist turned activist.
I'm aiming for around 80 today.
Knocking on doors in Pittsburgh, she tells me she used to spend time pushing lawmakers on climate change, but lawmakers told her voters didn't care.
The people who prioritize climate and the environment need to show up.
If the voter comes to the door, basically just follow the script.
The Environmental Voter Project is targeting very specific voters, environmentally conscious citizens, often young people and people of color, who rarely head to the polls. The group's founder, Nathaniel Stinnett, says they've had some success.
We've sometimes increased turnout as much as 1.8 percentage points in general elections, 3.6 points in primaries, and 5.7 points in local elections.
Okay, if I'm being honest, that doesn't sound like a lot.
Ask Donald Trump how big a deal 1.8% is in Pennsylvania, and I'll tell you.
The group is nonpartisan, though acknowledges it's almost exclusively Democrats right now working to address climate change. They hope they can push Republicans to come to the table, too.
We want to scare the bejesus out of as many politicians as possible, no matter what side of the aisle they're on, until they think, you know what? The only way I can win elections is if I start recognizing the biggest crisis that humanity faces.
But that's no easy task. Across the board this election, registered voters list immigration, the economy, abortion, and democracy as their top issues, with climate change not even making the top 10. Partisan and generational divides at play.
basically the younger the voter, the more they're likely to prioritize climate change as a voting issue. And yeah, that is going to be a reality that Republicans are going to need to grapple with eventually.
In November, the choice before voters is stark. But many Democrats worry young progressives might still stay home, despite the Biden administration investing billions to fight climate change.
What do you say to those young voters who argue he hasn't done enough?
The fact is, President Biden has done more to address climate change than any president in U.S. history. And there's a lot more to be done. Scientists have said that we still can avoid the worst of the climate crisis, but what we do in these next few years is essential.
Nathaniel says big policy matters, and too often Americans have been told to focus on their own small habits.
Don't pay attention to that coal-fired power plant back there. Instead, it's all your fault for having a plastic water bottle in your hand. And we bought it, when in truth, it is far more of a political and a systemic problem that needs political and systemic solutions.
It's an uphill battle, but for Emily, finding and activating these new voters is worth the fight.
The science is very clear, so we know what we need to do. It's just a matter of getting it done.
Mary Alice Parks, ABC News, Pittsburgh.
The power of young scientists. Two high schoolers from opposite ends of the country are investigating how to increase the honeybee population and explain why they're so important to our planet's ecosystems. ABC's M. Nguyen has their stories.
In the suburbs of San Ramon, California, a young beekeeper tending to her beehives in her backyard. 17-year-old Cherise Zoe instantly fell in love with nature's tiny workers when she learned how factors like climate change and pesticides were killing them off at an alarming rate. She jumped into action.
It's disappointing for me, but it's also a very real-world issue that we do need to take on.
Cherise transformed her backyard into a science project, constructing a maze to train honeybees how to fly through. These patterns and colors representing those of wildflowers. She set out to prove how certain pesticides may reduce bees' cognitive abilities. Cherise convinced her parents to help her acquire 150,000 honeybees.
This is so heavy because it's full of honey.
Full of honey, yes.
Wow.
When observing small groups of bees, she found the ones exposed to pesticides appeared not to remember how to get through the maze.
I wanted to see if my research could decrease the usage of pesticides in the real world.
Her work now submitted to a scientific journal.
They're our world's most crucial pollinators.
Bees alone pollinate 80% of all flowering plants, including more than 130 types of fruits and vegetables. But bee populations are rapidly declining, like the American bumblebee, where nearly 90% of them have been wiped out in the last 20 years.
Many of them are in danger.
Jim Veach, an avid beekeeper who specializes in genetics, says population declines can be due to several factors, though mainly habitat loss.
If bees poof disappear, then there's a huge economic hit to agriculture.
The Agricultural Research Service found radical shifts in temperature, droughts, wildfires, and floods resulted in habitat destruction and foraging disruptions. While honeybee populations have been relatively steady in recent years, they still face major threats like Barrero mites. In spring 2022, more than 40% of all honeybee colonies were afflicted with the parasite. That's where another young beekeeper comes in, 18-year-old Katie Colbert of Toms River, New Jersey.
You said they're pretty gentle?
Yes.
After weeks of field studies, her now-published work found that thymol-based essential oils extracted from thyme leaves through a mist diffuser could stun Barrero mites.
This continuous release system had an efficacy of over 97%, which is really promising and exciting.
Katie was crowned the Honey Queen, acting as a spokesperson for the New Jersey Beekeepers Association. With few young people having hive mind over beekeeping, Katie says knowing Cherise is out on the West Coast,
it makes me super excited that there's someone else out there who's like me.
So what can you do to help? Experts say you can avoid using pesticides and check with your local garden center about what plants are native to your area to put down around the house. And despite a sting or two,
it's pretty strong. I can't even barely walk.
Oh, wow.
Both of the girls' parents say it's worth it. What doesn't hurt? Having homegrown honey all year round.
Wow.
ABC's M. Nguyen. Coming up, treasuring the natural beauty around us on this special edition of Perspective. After this. You're listening to a special edition of Perspective from ABC News. I'm Dave Packer. As we continue to explore the power of us and the ways we can preserve our planet, we also look at how we can appreciate Earth's natural resources to boost our mental and physical health. ABC News medical correspondent Dr. Darian Sutton takes a look at one initiative that encourages folks to get outside.
ParkRx is a community health initiative that works to provide the prescription for wellness by getting more people outdoors.
You cannot get a better opportunity to reinvigorate yourself, to reset yourself, and then getting outside in the outdoors and taking a walk and being in the national parks.
Getting outside and exercising can help your health in a number of ways. Just simply getting exposure to sunlight can help you build up vitamin D, improving your immune health and your muscle function. Also, just simply being outside in green spaces can benefit your mental health. Walking and incorporating aerobic exercise can help keep your heart healthy and reduce stress.
Dozens of programs across the country are now available to help increase outdoor activity. One of these programs, Walk with the Doc, encourages patients to go outside and walk.
Walking is medicine, and for me, it's a form of medicine. And when I get outside and I start walking, it just feels freeing.
How much walking do I need to do every week? Is there a specific amount, or is there too little, too much? What do I need to do?
Important question. It's 150 minutes a week, so 20, 25 minutes a day. And if you miss a day, it's okay.
And I always think about this, you know, walking versus running. Do I have to be extra, exert myself beyond, or can I just simply walk?
Yeah, walking really gets it done. Running gets it done a little faster, but you get all the benefits from walking and it's lower impact.
When I look across our medical system and the ability of doctors to use all the tools that they can at hand, our Parks prescription program is probably a key to that. Being able to get and prescribe to people who are having stressful issues or who may need to do rehabilitation, getting them outside into the national parks or any park for that matter, so that they can enjoy and get through recovery, so that they can again reduce their stress level, so that they can center and focus on their own personal well-being. You can't ask for a better program.
Dr. Darian Sutton, ABC News, Rock Creek National Park.
Many are taking advantage of the outdoors by flocking to Death Valley National Park to witness a climate anomaly. ABC's Zareen Shaw has more on the rare wildflower bloom that's been surprising park rangers like Nicole Adler and leaving visitors mystified.
The blooms are back. Gorgeous fields of wildflowers taking over California. Bright yellow daisies even popping up in Death Valley, the driest and hottest place in America.
Our visitor center, which normally sees on a busy weekend 2,000 plus people a day, we were seeing well over 3,000 people a day.
The West Coast storms earlier this year leading to more than double the average rainfall in the area, turning the normally dry and empty Badwater Basin into a river that tourists kayak through.
Water has been key to Death Valley just having this unusual and amazing year.
Those major showers now bringing April flowers.
Death Valley, it's known for its rocks, sand, and now this super bloom-like phenomenon that goes for miles. A lot of rain has caused this extended bloom that a lot of people here say they've never seen before.
The last significant one happened in 2016, but park ranger Nicole Adler says this one is more of an extended bloom because of the length of time that the flowers have been blossoming.
The flowers started to bloom in November and just haven't stopped. And normally that does not happen.
Tourists as far as the Netherlands coming to see the valley now in awe.
Did you expect to come to Death Valley and see so many flowers?
Was the last place I expected so many flowers.
ABC's Zareen Shaw reporting. And if you're thinking of planning your own visit to one of the hundreds of national parks across the country, National Park Service Director Chuck Sams has some tips and tricks. Sam's telling ABC's Eva Pilgrim and Rhiannon Alley about what you need to know before you go.
Tell us some of the things that make the park such great places to travel to. What are some of the reasons people should go?
America's best idea is its national parks. There are over 429 national parks across the United States in all 50 states and U.S. territories. It's a great opportunity to visit them. Only about 100 of them actually have some fee, so they're very affordable for folks to get out and enjoy and recreate.
We like the affordable part of it, especially if you have children. They get real expensive real fast. What do people need to know when planning a trip to a park?
First and foremost, go to our site, nps.gov, and look up the park that you want to go into. And if you can, download our app. It will tell you everything you need to know about the parks before you go, including what the weather is, what the traffic is, whether you need to get a permit or a reservation. They're not always required, but it helps you actually plan that out. And we ask folks to plan like a ranger.
Plan like a ranger, that's all. You made history as the first Native American National Park Service director back in 2021. With that huge responsibility, what are your priorities as the director?
You know, I was very fortunate. I grew up on the Umatilla Indian Reservation in Northeast Oregon, and we're all about community. And so taking care of your people first and foremost. So coming into this job, we have 21,000 dedicated staff at the height of season across these 429 parks. We need to take care of those folks to make sure they have good pay, good housing, and things to do so that they are actually protecting and preserving these places we love. Next was actually working with tribes as a tribal member, ensuring that we're upholding our trust responsibility to the tribes under the federal government, ensuring that they have a chance to look at the parks and help plan those things so that people can continue to enjoy these parks for generations to come.
And we constantly see people taking selfies, doing things that maybe aren't safe in the national parks. What advice would you have for tourists regarding that? I can imagine that you just grimace whenever you hear these stories.
I do, because, you know, there is an abundance of flora and fauna out there, but we have a number of species of animals that are large, bison. And we ask people to use the rule of thumb. If you put your thumb out and it covers the animal, you're far enough away. If you can see the animal from around your thumb, you're way too close to that animal.
That's such a good tip.
ABC's Eva Pilgrim and Rhiannon Alley with National Park Service Director Chuck Sams. Before we go, the power of us in our own backyards. Catching a glimpse of some majestic animals may not require a trip to a far-off remote area. Whale enthusiasts in New York City can go right outside their door. Many document their sightings as part of the nonprofit group Gotham Whale. Danielle Brown is the Director of Marine Mammal Research for Gotham Whale and a naturalist for Jersey Shore Whale Watch.
Lots of fishermen will report their sightings to us. Also, folks on the beach, beachgoers during the summertime will report sightings to us. Just the average person who happens to be out having a good time on the water, they happen to see a whale and they contribute the sighting. And we're very grateful to all of those citizen scientists who have contributed data because they often collect data where our whale watching contributors don't go. So we get some really interesting sightings from our citizen scientists. So we're always looking to expand. Of course, we want to learn as much about these whales that are in our area as possible. So we definitely need those citizen science reports.
That data is compiled into a catalog system and helps the group track and identify whales during their migrations each year. Brown also says thanks to these citizen scientists, they can track critically endangered species and help with conservation efforts.
Many times our citizen scientists will report sightings of animals in either areas where we don't expect them to be. Also, what's even more important is that sometimes these citizen scientists will report sightings of species that we don't expect to see. So, for example, we've had several North Atlantic right whale sightings reported from citizen scientists. Right whales are common in this area during times of the year when there's not as many whale watching boats out there. So it's really important to get those sightings of North Atlantic right whales because they are so endangered. There's also times when we may receive a sighting of a species such as a North Atlantic right whale outside of the timing when we expect them to be here, which again is extremely important for protecting them.
More than 350 whales are already in the database, with more than half coming back to the region over and over again. Leaning on the power of some eagle-eyed New Yorkers, a prime example of the power we all have to help save the planet. Check out the rest of our Power of Us reporting wherever you get ABC News, on TV, streaming, on Hulu, and at abcnews.com. This has been a special edition of Perspective. From ABC News, this has been Perspective. Thanks for listening. This show was produced by Aaron Ferrer, Mara Milwaukee, and Joy Piazza. If you want to listen to any of our past shows, subscribe to the Perspective podcast. Give us a review. And if you've got the time, tell us what you'd like to hear in the future, what you think. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also find Perspective and other ABC News shows at abcaudio.com/podcasts. For ABC News, I'm Dave Packer.